You may be seated.
Thank you.
The next matter before the court this morning is in the matter of the discipline of Ronald Fruinshaw. Is that correct?
Fruinshaw.
Thank you. Appearing for the disciplinary board, Tom Freeburg will be arguing. Bob Freeburg is also present, and James Moore is appearing on behalf of the respondent. Each side has 15 minutes for argument, and I don't know, Mr. Moore, I would include any statement that your client wants to make in that 15 minutes. I don't know if he intends to make a statement this morning or not.
But yes, sir.
Okay. I'll leave that up to you how you want to make that presentation, but that'll be part of your 15 minutes. Okay. Mr. Freeburg, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Fruinshaw. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. It's been about a little more than 3 years since we've been before the court with a disciplinary board matter, and that's the good news we bring to you is that the board's been working hard to try and make sure they're intervening early and trying to prevent cases from coming to this stage where they come before you. I understand you don't want to hear probably significantly from me, but I do have some points I want to bring out to you with respect to the board's position in this matter and why they made the recommendation they did in sending this matter to the court. The board took this matter very seriously. When the complaint first came in, you always look at a complaint and wonder, is this just a disgruntled prosecutor who there was an acquittal in the case, or was there something more to this that really broached the rules of professional conduct? And as we reviewed the case at the board level, it became apparent that there were some significant issues that needed to be addressed, and it was hoped that when we came to a hearing with Mr. Fruinshaw that many of those issues could be resolved. However, it didn't turn out that way. In the board hearing, which was held in September of 2021, there were a lot of concerns that were unable to be resolved by the board that were raised by Mr. Golden and in the complaint that led to the hearing. During his opening statement before the board, Mr. Fruinshaw went to get great lengths to explain why he felt Judge Rasmussen was wrong in her rulings. This set the tone for the hearing, was very troubling to the board, and the board, through the questioning of board members, tried to give Mr. Fruinshaw the opportunity to try and back off of that position somewhat, but it never really happened. There was a number of occasions during the hearing where Mr. Fruinshaw talked about the errors of the court and the rulings of the court, and at the conclusion of his closing remarks, after about 2 hours in front of the board, and he felt a bit beat up at that point, I believe, but I think the board's questions were fair. They were to the point, and trying to get to the bottom of why he conducted himself in the manner that he did. When he started his closing remarks, he pointed out by making a comment that we all make mistakes, and specifically alluded to Judge Rasmussen and Bill Golden, the prosecutor in this matter, about some of the mistakes they made. And at the conclusion of his closing statement, he made an apology to the board and said to the board, if I cross the line in your mind. And I thought that was very instructive to the board that there was no sense from Mr. Fruinshaw that he had crossed the line in doing the questioning that he had done through voir dire and through his opening statements and through questioning of his expert witness. Another concern the board had was that Mr. Fruinshaw felt all along that Judge Rasmussen had made an error early in the proceedings and that therefore she was incorrect in a number of other rulings that she made. Before Judge Crandall at the referee hearing, Mr. Fruinshaw still believed that but for his microphone having been left on during a motion for mistrial, that it would have been, that it was incorrect for Judge Rasmussen to order the mistrial. Again, this came after five or six different motions or objections from Mr. Golden and then curative instructions made by Judge Rasmussen. Mr. Fruinshaw felt that another curative instruction would have been sufficient and that Judge Rasmussen was incorrect in ruling that there be a mistrial in this matter. When Mr. Golden testified before the referee, he also made some comments which I think are important in this case. As a former defense attorney, Mr. Golden said, I want to make sure that I've got a clean record if this matter becomes an appeal issue or is a habeas issue. He tried during conversations with Mr. Franchu before and during the trial to make sure that he was going to be in compliance with court orders. Mr. Golden never had a comfort level that that was going to be the case. And I believe his testimony before Judge Trandall indicated that he would walk away from conversations with Mr. Franchu convinced that he wasn't going to follow Judge Rasmussen's orders. In fact, during the testimony, Mr. Golden indicated that prior to trial, he and Amanda Eden, the deputy state's attorney who he worked with on the case, had discussions about the real possibility that there could be a mistrial because they were not confident that Mr. Franchu would conduct himself in a manner that would prevent a mistrial and that he was not willing to comply with the orders of Judge Rasmussen. Judge Rasmussen's testimony was also indicative of this. She had some concerns about Mr. Franchu from the onset. One of the early motions in the case was a Miranda-type motion based upon a telephone conversation between law enforcement and the defendant who was in Rapid City at the time. Judge Rasmussen started out wondering, is this an issue of whether or not Mr. Franchu is competent, or does he just not understand or is just being defiant with the court as he moved forward? She indicated that during the course of the proceedings, she evolved from the point of maybe there's an issue of his ability being compromised to the point that he just wasn't going to follow her orders. And that was frustrating to her, frustrating to the prosecution, and ultimately frustrating to the process. Mr. Franchu passes these off as being poor or sloppy questions when he's talking about the questions he was asking of his expert. But it was apparent to the board that Mr. Franchu was going to push the envelope and go as far as he could. And frankly, he pushed it way too far in this matter and ultimately resulted in the mistrial that brings him before the court today.
So when I read that, those portions of the testimony from Judge Trandall's referee hearing, Mr. Freeburg, I saw what you just described, which is this sense from both Mr. Golden and Judge Rasmussen that, hey, maybe there are competency issues. But the board's, in its investigation, apparently resolved that that was not the case because that's not a basis for the disciplinary. In other words, the competency rule is not a basis for the disciplinary action here. So is it fair to infer from that that the board resolved that that wasn't really what was going on?
Yeah, I think it is. The board reached the same conclusion that Judge Trandall did, and I think that Judge Rasmussen did at the trial level, is that this was just open defiance, and he was going to take a win-at-all-costs approach, even if that involved violating the court's orders.
Mr. Freeburg,
yes?
Maybe before you get back to your facts, and if you want to go further in those, you can, but I want to ask about your recommendation for the suspension that the board made and that Judge Trandall also reaffirmed. Obviously, you're familiar with the case law, disciplinary case law, this court. Do you think that there are similar cases? Did the board look at that in terms of coming up with 3 months? And if so, which cases did the court consider? What cases do you think are most relevant or applicable to this case in terms of the appropriate discipline?
You know, the board didn't. I think the board felt that some suspension was necessary, that this conduct exceeded. They didn't necessarily look to full precedent. There's not really been a case exactly like this type where a mistrial with numerous violations of court orders or the cause of the mistrial. The three-month suspension was intentional on the board's part because of the rule that if a attorney is suspended from practice by 3 months or less, they are not required to go back through the reinstatement process. So that was the thought process with the board, is that there needed to be some message sent that this conduct of violating court orders was not appropriate, and that a suspension of some sort was necessary to rectify the situation. They didn't necessarily go through a comparison of prior cases. You know, the 90-day suspensions, a lot of those are consented to, frankly, by attorneys, knowing that if they challenge it, it could be much worse if this court determines that the board's recommendation is not adequate under the circumstances. So,
thank you.
Another factor I just wanted to point out is that the court in issuing the trial court, Judge Rasmussen, in her mistrial order indicated that there would be a further or future hearing on sanctions or contempt. That never did occur. And when Mr. Franchu was questioned about that by the board, it appeared to the board anyway that he took that as license to say maybe Judge Rasmussen was wrong. And so he continued to pursue in his opening the line of questioning about the expert and where the expert might go. Ultimately, after a couple of objections and reprimand from the court, Mr. Franchu moved forward throughout the rest of the case without objections. And that was one of the issues about the competence versus intentional act that the board felt was important to point out, was that he had the ability to comply because he did. In the second trial, after the first early objections about in the opening statement, he did comply. And so it was very troubling to the board that if he were confused about what was expected or what could be done in his examination of his expert witness, he never did go back to Judge Rasmussen and seek clarity on exactly what he could and couldn't do. Instead, he took it as an indication that perhaps she was wrong yet again and had read the transcript and that he was not acting inappropriately in asking the questions that he did of his expert.
Counsel, how significant to the board were the prior admonishments in 96 and 2011?
The board always looks at the history of any person that comes before them. I think the most troubling part of that, Justice Curran, was the admonishment for leaving a courtroom after having been ordered to stay by the trial judge. That really was concerning to the board when they look at this conduct and say, you know, this isn't an isolated instance. There is a history, and granted it was several years ago, but Mr. Franchu, by his admission and testimony, left the courtroom because he was angry with the judge on a ruling about a visitation matter that had been back before the judge a number of times on a child custody matter. And he simply walked out after the court ordered him to stay. And that was very troubling to the board. Granted, it was a number of years ago, but that was a significant factor that they looked at in determining not only the intent in this matter, but what appropriate sanction might be for Mr. Franchu. When the board looked at the entirety of the case, again, they came to the conclusion that the 3-month suspension would be appropriate. I know that Mr. Franchu actually came back to the board the day after his hearing and indicated that he might simply resign from the bar. Then chairperson of the board, Julie Dvorak, and myself told him he shouldn't act in a rash manner, to at least think about it. But we did provide him the opportunity to resign if that was his desire. Later on in the process, he decided that that was not what he was going to do, and then again pursued the action before this court, asking for consideration by the court to not go along with the 3-month suspension requested by the board. I want to point out Judge Crandall did, and you've obviously seen the very thorough job that she did in reporting to you the findings and conclusions. She reached the same recommendation that the board did. Obviously, you're free to make any decision you wish with respect to the recommendation, but the board would respectfully ask that you support their decision in this matter, as well as Judge Crandall's. And I'm happy to answer any other questions that you might have.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Moore, you may proceed at this time.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. James Moore on behalf of Ronald Frauenschuh. Even though there are no briefs in this case, I think that our position is pretty clear from the brief that was submitted to the referee after the hearing that was held in front of the referee and to the objections that we made to the referee's proposed findings and conclusions. So my intention is not to make extended argument today, but to highlight a few of the reasons that we're here, to share with you my concerns about this matter, and then to give Mr. Frauenschuh an opportunity to address you. I see four things in this matter that I think deserve attention. One is obviously the recommended discipline, which we've argued a suspension is extraordinarily harsh on the facts of this case for multiple reasons. When I look at this court's body of disciplinary cases, and we did an extensive look at the cases to try to figure out if we had a reasonable argument that a suspension is not appropriate here, this court's cases have really dealt with suspensions in several different circumstances. One is cases involving dishonesty with trust accounts or false statements. One is cases involving violations of state or federal law. One is breaches of duty owed to a client. None of those circumstances are really present in this case involving trial-related conduct. Under the ABA standards, I don't think that we're talking about the breach of a duty owed to a client here. I think we're talking about a duty owed to the court, to the legal profession. And under the ABA standards, I think those things are different. Chief Justice Jensen, you asked about, you know, this court's authority and what cases are most applicable and what's similar. Justice Konenkamp wrote a concurrence in the Tornow decision in which he referenced the ABA standards, said the ABA standards are helpful for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is so that there's some consistency in terms of what we do with respect to discipline in these matters. And when I look at this court's cases, the two that stand out to me with respect to this matter are the Tornow decision, in which Mr. Tornow received a public censure for conduct that this court found was dishonest, and that Mr. Tornow was guilty of misrepresentations. I think in that sense that his conduct was qualitatively different and in a way much worse than what happened here. And if you read the Tornow decision, it says that his conduct did not occur. One of the factors that was addressed there is that it did not occur in the heat of trial, which is something that happened here. The second case that I look at is the Ben Eicher decision. Mr. Eicher got a 100-day suspension, 10 days more than has been recommended for Mr. Frauenschuh, based on conduct that I think is truly egregious and not even remotely similar to what occurred in this case. So the first reason we're here is because I think that the discipline that's been recommended is too harsh. The second reason is because I think the disciplinary board clearly relied on Mr. Frauenschuh's history of disciplinary conduct in Minnesota, all of which occurred before 2001. The referee also clearly relied on that. Under the ABA standards and a number of cases that we cited, given the age of those disciplinary matters, that is a mitigating factor suggesting that they not be given the same consideration as aggravating factors. And Justice Kern, I want to respond specifically to Mr. Freeburg's response to your question, because while the referee and the board clearly were concerned about the incident in which Mr. Frauenschuh walked out of the courtroom, what's not in the findings from the referee is Mr. Frauenschuh's testimony. There's no excuse for that behavior. I was a young man. I was a zealous advocate, and I made a mistake. Clear in the record, not in the findings. I think it needs to be recognized that Mr. Frauenschuh explained the circumstances in his life at that time that he had a serious burn injury, that he was diagnosed late with post-traumatic stress disorder, that he treated for that, that it made him a different person, that it made him a different lawyer, that it made him a better lawyer, that he learned from those instances, and we have no record of disciplinary conduct between 2001 and this trial in front of Judge Rasmussen. And under those circumstances, I think it's inconsistent with the ABA standards and with a number of cases to suggest that discipline is an aggravating factor, and there's absolutely no doubt from the findings here that it was used as an aggravating factor by both the disciplinary board and the referee. Thirdly, I think it's very important that you consider very carefully what rules of professional conduct may have been violated here, and to look at cases and commentary in the rules and determine whether the facts match up to those. The disciplinary board did not do that. It threw out a laundry list of rules that it thought were violated, but no conclusions of law or factual statements expressly saying this is how this rule was violated, and no citation to cases explaining that. The referee was much more responsive to that because we submitted a brief that went through rule by rule. The referee did go rule by rule. The referee's conclusions of law do not include citation to cases for the most part, explaining how a particular rule was violated on the facts of this case. And I think it's...
I'm sorry, Mr. Morton. Do you disagree with the referee's determinations of the rules that were violated?
In a number of cases, I do, Your Honor. The one that the referee conceded was not at issue was an attempt to influence a judge, a juror, or prospective juror by means prohibited by law, which is Rule 3.5A. The board had found a violation there. The referee did not. I think that with respect to Rule 3.4C, which is knowingly disobeying an obligation under the rules of the tribunal, that's the one that is most applicable based on whether you conclude on the facts of this case that Mr. Frauenschuh's conduct with respect to the questions that he posed to Dr. Atkins or a statement that he made about what Dr. Atkins was going to testify to was, in fact, contrary to Judge Rasmussen's order. Aside from that, I have an issue with all of the other rules, and that's what's outlined in the post-hearing brief we submitted. And my point is not to stand here and argue that no discipline is appropriate in this case, but one of the other concerns that I have is that this did involve trial-related conduct, and not critical of Judge Rasmussen for not imposing sanctions in this case, but she said at one point she was going to do that. I understand why it didn't happen given the procedural history of the case. But again, if you look at the ABA standards, the imposition of other penalties is a mitigating factor with respect to discipline that may be imposed. And I think that a trial court, you all know this better than I do, a trial court is in a good position to address this sort of conduct that occurs at trial. And I think the trial court is in a better position to address it than the disciplinary board after the fact. And even though Judge Rasmussen testified before the referee, Mr. Freeburg has highlighted some of the things that that she said that that were a concern to the disciplinary board and that supported the referee's findings. But I asked her on cross-examination if she thought that Mr. Frauenschuh's violation with respect to the Atkins order was intentional, and she told me she wasn't sure that it was. It's not a lot of fun to cross-examine a sitting circuit court judge, and I got that answer and I moved on. I think that there is a fair amount of ambiguity and uncertainty of the record about that. And one of the things I keep hearing over and over in this case is that there were multiple violations of pretrial orders. There's only one pretrial order that's at issue in this case. And I think if you look carefully at the question that Mr. Frauenschuh asked Dr. Atkins, I went back and forth on this when I first looked at the case. The problem for me is that he used the defendant in the question. I don't think it was a good question. I think that probably is what caused Judge Rasmussen to think it was a clear violation of her order. But I also asked Judge Rasmussen at the hearing before the referee if Mr. Frauenschuh could have asked Dr. Atkins if he diagnosed the defendant with somnambulism. And she said yes. And that is absolutely the functional equivalent of everything that her order said could not be asked. So, again, I'm not saying that Judge Rasmussen was not in a position to say that you violated the terms of my order, but I think there's considerable uncertainty in the record whether that was intentional. And if it was not intentional, I think that the disciplinary outcome is different in this case.
On that point, counsel, in reading the record, you said there was only one pretrial order at issue, and you know, in looking at the underlying trial transcript, it looked like there were also objections with regard to things that pertain to alleged victim's counseling records or whether they had counseling. And it seemed like there was a few other things. And that my sense is that the ultimate mistrial decision wasn't just obviously that particular alleged violation of the order with regard to the expert testimony, that it was this accumulation of multiple in chambers discussions constantly happen with related to various sorts of conduct. And although the expert one is the one that got the attention at the board hearing, but could you address that?
Yes, I agree that the mistrial was the result of cumulative conduct. I don't see in the record that there were any other pretrial orders that were allegedly violated that were part of that cumulative conduct. The cumulative conduct were the questions asked during voir dire of the first panel, and there were two panels that day because this was a trial during COVID. The Dr. Atkins testimony and the instances of the microphone being left on in the hallway. And I think the microphone is what pushed it over the edge, and that's consistent with Mr. Golden's testimony, who said that he thought that was fatal because essentially the jury heard him make a motion for a mistrial because the microphone was left on, and that clearly was there's nothing in the record that indicates that that was intentional. There's nothing in the record that indicates that Mr. Frauenschuh wanted a mistrial, that it was going badly, that it would help him in some way. You know, he tried the second case at no cost to his client and got a good result. And, you know, at the end of the day, the question is this a case in which there's evidence that we need to protect the public from Mr. Frauenschuh? So I didn't mean to take this much time. I want you to have an opportunity to hear from him. Thank you.
And Mr. Frauenschuh, I know there's only 2 minutes up on the board, but take the time you want to take to tell us what you wanted to tell us today.
Thank you very much. I wish I had met each of you under different circumstances, and I apologize to the court for being here for my conduct. I want to give a brief background to where I'm at with my practice and where I was. And I graduated from Washburn University School of Law in Topeka, Kansas. They specialized in ag law, and that was an area in which I was particularly interested in.
If you could just speak up just a little bit, you're soft.
And that's part of the problem I'm having currently with the stroke. I've had a second stroke in the early part of this year. It affects my balance and my voice. And it was partially affecting my voice during the trial the first time. And I've had a consistent problem with my voice since 2011 when I had the stroke and recovered. I want to go back, though, and talk a little bit about the PTSD. I had had a very serious burn action. I had skin grafting over, I think it was 13 to 15% of my body, my right arm and chest. I poured Crisco oil that was on fire over myself. I then went through a divorce. I left the hospital around October 15th of that year and went through a divorce with her having an affair in the following December. All of that just was too much for me to handle. And at that time, we didn't know what PTSD was. So I struggled through and with depression. I couldn't sleep at night. My mood was altered. I was not professionally sound, quite frankly. And I made a number of mistakes. In 2001, I appeared. A number of the issues had risen in front of the Supreme Court in Minnesota, and I appeared before a family law institute, and my name appeared almost solidly for an hour on how bad a person I was, on how bad I was doing, and I knew when I left that seminar that I had to make changes. And so in 2001, I began to make changes. I began to make changes so I would not make the same mistakes I made then. I changed my policy for telephone calls. I returned all telephone calls, as a matter of course, within 48 hours. I had written contracts with every client, and I do today. I had written orders from court so I wouldn't violate the court orders, and then I could give the experts the written order of the court so they would understand. I did not want to ever be before you or before any board discussing my bad behavior. The jury trial between Kendra Lindblad and the state, I have extreme respect for Judge Rasmussen. She had a number of difficult decisions to make. The problem I had is I had a difficult client, and I was constantly trying to mitigate her feelings towards the judge and tell my client that the judge is making the correct decision. If we wanted to change the law, it would have to be done, but I told her we really didn't want to do that because she would lose, and if she was found guilty, then we would have the issue before the Supreme Court. She was constantly pushing me on the issues of whether she was a lesbian. That was before the court, whether the victim made mistakes. I was kind of a balance between the two, but it was a very difficult balance. I did not want to try the case. I had no interest in trying the case. That's why I went, the first appearance in South Dakota, I went to Mr. Golden, Ms. Eden, and talked to them, trying to work out or seeing if a possibility of settlement was possible. It was not. Bottom line is, I didn't make mistakes. I apologize to the court, and it will never happen again. The current status of my practice, I have closed my Minnesota office because of health concerns. Doctors have told me I got to slow down. My first mainway has been the practice of law, and I would work 70 to 80 hours a week. I'm now down to an average of 40 and only in Watertown. I've sold my building. I'm in the process of decreasing my practice because I just can't do it anymore. But I love to serve, and I will find other ways to serve. I think I remember during my burn accident, my grandmother walking up to my bed. I was in the airplane position, and she said, "Ron, you don't know my God has allowed this to happen, but you'll be a better person in the end." My conduct didn't do that in this case, and that I apologize for.
A couple questions. First off, you said you're working about 40 hours a week in your practice. Can you just give the court a little flavor of what your current practice involves and where you're practicing?
In Watertown, South Dakota.
So only Coddington County?
I would say 90% of the practice is actually Grant over Milbank because of the closeness to Ortonville. That people have known me for years. And I practice probably 10% in Coddington. I do mainly, I would say, 40% mediation. I do probably 20% wills and trusts and probates. And I have to do occasional criminal law. I do not The current memo I'm doing right now is I asked the client, do you have a case or do you want me to walk you through the proceeding? And so I'm not actively pursuing the criminal case except to be an assistance to clients.
And your criminal defense work, is that all privately retained, or are you doing public defender work?
Privately retained.
Tell me about the impact that the board's recommended suspension will have on your practice. You said that a 3-month suspension will be career-ending. Can you discuss that?
The issue is he throws in credibility. And when they see, the public sees the bad conduct a second time, there just won't be any business. They won't come in. It took me 5 years to recover from the first time, and a lot of hard work. I really made some substantial changes in that 5 years.
What 5-year time frame are you
referencing? 2001 to 2006, it had a substantial, that a reprimand had a substantial impact on my business. All I'll say is, God willing, I was able to stay open.
So it's not the length of time, really. It's the suspension itself.
Yes.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Frownshaw.
Thank you.
That will conclude the case. The case will take, the court will take the matter under submission and render a written decision. We're going to stay in the courtroom. You can go ahead and get your things gathered, and then we're going to have a short rules hearing.